You are listening to the Cycling Podcast.
Welcome, listeners, to this special episode of the Cycling Podcast. Now, as I'm sure many of you will have noticed, we haven't heard from our colleague Lizzie Banks on the podcast for several months. Earlier this week, Lizzie made public that for the last 10 months, she has in fact been fighting to clear her name for a doping case that had been brought against her in July last year. UCAD, the UK anti-doping agency, notified Lizzie that she had returned an adverse analytical finding, an AAF, more commonly known as a positive test for two substances. One, formoterol, an asthma medication that she was permitted to use and had been using for 4 years previous, and the second one, more crucially, was clortalidone, a diuretic on the prohibited list of the World Anti-Doping Agency, better known as WADA, for its potential as a masking agent. Despite the diuretic being found at a low level, she was told that she would be facing a 2-year suspension unless she could establish a source. Since then, Lizzie has been investigating, researching and writing submissions to establish how the contamination occurred. Not to mention suffering physically, mentally and financially from the huge toll that the situation had placed on her. Her case was to go to tribunal in April this year, but 5 days beforehand, Lizzie was absolved of any blame, with UCAD concluding that Lizzie bore no fault or negligence for the positive test. For this episode, and in the interests of transparency, we've asked Tom Carey, senior sports correspondent at The Telegraph, to interview Lizzie for the Cycling Podcast. A few abbreviations will come up, so just to give some clarity, WADA is the World Anti-Doping Agency, UCAD is the UK Anti-Doping Agency, which is responsible for making sure that British athletes comply with the WADA code, CAS is the Court of Arbitration for Sport, an independent institution involved in resolving legal disputes in the field of sport. AAF is an adverse analytical finding, commonly known as a positive doping test. MRL stands for minimum reporting limit, the concentration below which a substance will not trigger a positive test. ADRV stands for anti-doping rules violation. Reference is also made to the cases of Shari Bossert and Toon Aerts. Both riders were given 2-year suspensions for testing positive for letrozole, which both claim is the result of food contamination. And a warning, this podcast does contain references to suicide and suicidal thoughts.
Lizzie, thanks for talking to us today. I thought it'd be best if we go right back to the start initially, because you probably need to provide a bit of context for, you know, when you received your test result, where you were exactly in your career. So we hadn't seen much of you for a couple of seasons anyway. You'd had, you know, horrific luck with first concussions and COVID when you tried to make your comeback. Then you had managed to get some racing in last year. But I think probably when you fell off the radar, everyone assumed maybe that you'd gone into retirement, or that we just hadn't seen much of you continuing to battle those struggles. But where exactly were you when this happened?
Yeah, so that's the thing. I sort of fell off the face of the earth for the last 10 months. And firstly, I want to say sorry that I just disappeared, but I simply couldn't talk about what was happening. And I received a lot of lovely messages from people that I just simply couldn't reply to after the last months. And yeah, I'm happy that we can finally talk about this and I can finally tell you all what's been going on, because it's been really just one of the worst things that I've been through in my life. It was the 28th of July. I was out on a bike ride. I'd just done my first 4-hour ride since the Giro. A member of my family had just had a really awful accident, actually, where he broke his spine and crushed his spinal cord. And, you know, I'd crashed at the Giro and things were not going well. And this was my first 4-hour ride since the Giro. I finally felt good again. I felt mentally good. I felt physically good. I'd stopped in a little town called Cecil, which is just near the Grand Colombier, about 50 kilometers from home. Stopped to get Coke, looked at my phone, had an email from UCAD, UK Anti-Doping, which isn't that unusual in itself, but the contents of the letter were, it said, please confirm that this is your email address. We have a very important correspondence to send to you. I replied immediately, and I can only describe it as I just completely freaked out. 5 agonizing minutes later, sitting in the village square, I then received a letter from UCAD saying that I had tested positive for two substances. So I had an AAF, which is an adverse analytical finding, which is commonly just known as a positive test. So the two substances were formoterol, which is a medication that I take in an inhaler called Symbicort, and I've taken this medication since 2020. I've had many, many anti-doping tests whilst having taken this medication, and so I thought, well, that doesn't make any sense. It's got an amount that you're allowed to take it to, but I've always been so careful about that amount. And the second substance was a substance called chlortalidone, which after a quick Google, I found out was a diuretic. And that also didn't make any sense because I was certain it wasn't in any of my medications. I'm rigorous about checking what's in my medications. I do take a number of medications because, as you know, I've had a number of health conditions and I have a number of chronic health conditions as well. And I mean, I panicked. I had no idea what to do. I called my husband. I was not in a fit state to ride home. I was miles away from home. I then called the dentist because the day before I'd actually been at the dentist having two fillings done on my two molars on either side. And I was there for 2 hours. They couldn't get proper anesthesia. They used loads of dental anesthetic. So then I thought, well, that is so out of the ordinary for me to have that before a doping test.
So it said in that initial letter you got from UCAD, it said when the test took place. Because I was going to ask, you know, how long before you received this letter had this test in fact taken place?
Well, so that's the thing. So I received the results on the 28th of July, and the test was on the 11th of May. So it was a 79-day period between the test and the results. So the one thing that popped out at me was, oh, I remembered that I'd been to the dentist the day before. I had these photos, I had all these messages, and I phoned them and I said, oh, you know, was this substance used? And they said no. And I just thought, well, like, what the hell? How, if it wasn't something that the dentist had used, how the hell am I going to find this? You know, trying to find something that's a contaminant would be hard enough if you were trying to find it from something you'd eaten and drunk or taken the day before, but from something 3 months ago, I just felt like I was looking for a needle in a barn of haystacks, but the haystacks weren't even still in the barn. They'd been sold and distributed, and I still had to try and find this needle, and they were just like, okay, good luck, off you go. I was overwhelmed, and I just had no idea what I was going to do. The only way that I can describe it is I just felt that my life was completely over.
So you rang your husband, and he came and got you, did he? And you exhausted that initial search with the dentist. We had to tell a few people, I imagine, your agent, your team.
I phoned my husband, I phoned my agent. Gabriel came to pick me up. We went straight to the dentist. They phoned the actual dentist who saw me. She remembered me, and she was pregnant. And I thought maybe she was taking a diuretic. She wasn't. I got home within 2 minutes of getting home. I was on the phone to my team boss. I told her immediately. And then whilst I was having that call with the team boss, I got a call back from Mike Morgan at Morgan Sports Law. And that was the call that changed everything for me. And unfortunately, it was the beginning of a process that made me completely lose faith in the anti-doping processes.
Just on your team bus first, we'll get onto Mike Morgan in a minute, but what was her initial reaction? Because obviously when you trigger one of these, you're provisionally suspended. Was she supportive?
She was incredibly supportive. I mean, I was a complete wreck. I, you know, as we discussed later, I had no idea where this came from, and I've always been fastidiously careful with what I put in my body. So I knew right from the outset it was going to be so hard because I'm so careful anyway. It just didn't make any sense. And if I was that careful, then how on earth was I going to find this thing? And she was obviously shocked. I was obviously shocked. I'd only known for 2 hours or something by this point, maybe 3 hours. But she was incredibly supportive. She was just like, this doesn't make sense. This isn't you. She knows me. I, you know, a lot of people listening to this will know me, and I am an open book. And, you know, I've always been so hard-lined on anything that is unfair. My belief in fairness and what is right, it drives everything that I do and everything that I am. I will always stand up for fairness for whoever it is, whether or not that means that it's not actually a good thing for me. You know, times in the past when in teams I'd stood up for people when I knew I was going to get it in the neck for standing up for them, but if it wasn't right, I was always going to do it. And so she was, yeah, she was amazing, really. She was very, very supportive. And yeah, like I said, halfway through that call, I got a call back from Mike Morgan, and that just
So what did he say? Why did that change everything? I imagine this 79-day period, that was a real problem, because he said it's hard enough anyway to prove where a contaminant comes from, and in this case it's going to be even harder.
Yeah, at this point, I didn't realise that the 79-day period was really unusual because I've never had this happen to me before. So I sent them the file and they looked at everything. But what really shocked me from that first call with him was quite how widespread the contamination can be, where it can come from. I was aware that supplements could be contaminated. In my case, I was almost like 99.999% certain it wasn't supplements because A, I'm incredibly careful. B, I only use batch tested supplements. I only use very few of them. And I also know that I've been using exactly the same batch from my previous anti-doping tests. So it just didn't make any sense that it could be that. What I learned from Mike Morgan is that contamination can come from pharmaceuticals. It can come from water. It can come from contaminated surfaces. If somebody's been in your house who's had either that pharmaceutical or a contaminated pharmaceutical, it can come from there. And that's when I sort of, although Mike reassured me that even when you don't have the original batches of medication, which of course I didn't have the original batches of medication, these are medications I use every day, and it was 3 months ago, so obviously I didn't still have those batches. He said, no, you'd be surprised. We often find things. So I was trying to keep hope. But yet, I was like, well, if it was water that I drank 3 months ago, how am I going to find that? It was so overwhelming. And the pharmaceuticals thing was really, really scary for me because I took a bunch of medications for a bunch of health conditions to keep me healthy. And after I got this positive test, I was completely paralyzed by fear for taking my medications, eating anything, drinking anything. I was just petrified. I didn't touch anything that even was slightly processed, like biscuits and sweets even, you know? But then with the pharmaceuticals, I didn't touch them. I stopped taking them. And within 1-2 weeks, especially with this stressful situation, I got really, really, really ill, and I was forced into a point where I was actually at a crisis with my asthma, and I had to take my medication because I was so unwell. And every time I took my inhalers and took my tablets, I basically had a panic attack because I didn't know if antidoping were going to come again the next day. Like, you don't know when they're going to come. You put in your whereabouts 3 months in advance and they can come at any time. And that anxiety and that fear, coupled with this sense that your life was over, I can talk about it now, and I can get through this story without breaking down into tears and just being a complete hysterical mess. But it's probably taken me 5-6 months to be able to get to this point where I can actually tell somebody new about the story and tell them succinctly and clearly without just breaking down and crying. It was just so horrible to have everything I've worked hard for, and the worst thing for me was my integrity, to have my integrity stripped from me so unceremoniously for having literally done nothing. Like, we learned that this was a contamination amount, we learned that it probably was from a pharmaceutical, and like, I don't know, I just knew that this was going to go out, everybody was going to call me a doper. Not only was my life in cycling definitely over because I was never, ever going to risk doing this again to my family, but how would I ever get a job in anything ever again? People would Google me and they'd just see Lizzie Banks doper. And yeah, it was horrendous. I was worried I would lose my friends. I knew I'd lost my job. I'd lost my income. I thought I'd lost absolutely everything. And it was...
So you're obviously battling with your physical health. You said about stopping taking your medication. You reached that crisis point. Your mental health was not in a good place at that time. I mean, you would also have known, because we've seen this happen to so many other athletes, that these stories come out and the athlete in question says every time, whether they're guilty or not, I'm innocent. It must be a contamination, there must be some mistake in the test. So you knew that, you know, for these charges ever, or for the public to believe you again, you were going to have to prove somehow that this was a contaminant. So you had that stress going on as well.
Absolutely. So right from the beginning, the lawyers told me, so I commissioned some lawyers because, I mean, what else do you do? You have no idea how to fix this. And in the beginning, you kind of have hope that you're going to find it, right? And there have been quite a few cases recently in cycling, particularly the Shari Bosoit case. she was given a 2-year ban. They didn't think that she'd done it intentionally. They think that they believe her where it came from, but because she couldn't prove the specific source, and this is the principle of strict liability upon which WADA is based, because she couldn't prove the specific source, i.e. find the milk or piece of meat or whatever that was contaminated with, in Shari's case, 1.9 nanograms per milliliter of letrozole, if she couldn't find that and then do a scientific study to prove it, then she couldn't get less than 2 years. So I was really acutely aware of this. And so many times in the process, I just thought, well, what the hell is the point? You know, right from the beginning, I basically started collecting medications. Any that I did still have the batch of, we sent off. Others, I went to so many pharmacies trying to find different batch numbers for different medications from pharmacies that I did get them from before, to get all of these different medications tested for chlortalidone. I didn't have enough money to do it all in one go because it's a very expensive process. For instance, with paracetamol, we knew I'd taken some paracetamol the day before after this horrible dental treatment, and I had 9 different sachets of paracetamol with different batch numbers or different brands on. So we tested every single one, and that's £1,800, just like that, gone. And I didn't have that much money to just test everything. So we had to do it sequentially, because if we found the contaminant in one of the first batches, it didn't make sense to have spent 10,000 testing everything and actually found it in the first batch of paracetamol. But as I went through more and more batches, and then we weren't finding it and we weren't finding it and weren't finding it, my hope just, I started to begin to lose hope, basically.
Yeah, and losing a lot of money as well. I mean, you mentioned £1,800. How much do you estimate you spent overall doing all these tests?
In total, in the tests, I don't know, maybe like 12,000, I think. But in total, the amount that we've spent is around 40,000. And a lot of that's legal fees, a lot of it's testing, then there's other stuff associated. After 2.5 months, I couldn't afford the legal support anymore. Mm. And I had to sort of relinquish, effective legal support. And at this point, I just thought, what is the point in going on my own? Because I knew, basically, UCAD would only settle for a 2-year ban. And I, at this point, had read the WADA rules inside out. And I believe that the WADA rules, as they are written, mean that I should not get any sanction at all, which is what ended up happening in the end, subject to appeal by WADA. And so I got to this point where we were a few months in, we tested a lot of things, we hadn't found the contaminant. I'd spoken to everybody that had been in my house or that I'd been in contact with. Not a single person had used this medication. I had got the batch certificates for every single one of my supplements. I had checked everything that I'd eaten that I could possibly remember in the previous week and everywhere that I'd been. And I wanted to go to tribunal because UCAD said, so they weren't prepared to have anything less than 2 years. I thought I should get 0. And basically the matter was referred to a tribunal because it was the only way to sort it out. I was told by the lawyers that realistically going to a tribunal would cost at least £100,000. Now, I estimate that I have spent at least 1,500 hours on this case. And given the fact that I was told that unless I found the specific source, I would not have anything other than a 2-year ban, I think that £100,000 is way, way, way less than you would have actually had to spend if you were employing someone to do this case. Because I did, so many hundreds of hours of research and investigation and that kind of thing, and writing. My final submissions were 144 pages and over 40,000 words. And I had over 120 pieces of evidence, which was scientific evidence, documentation, medical records, everything.
I think it's important to say at this point, obviously, you trained, for those that don't know your story, many will who are listening to this, but you did medical training yourself. So you were sort of uniquely well qualified for this task. I know it obviously took its toll on you, but you had the means, relatively speaking, at least to start this investigation yourself. You had the medical knowledge to really look into this issue, and you had the sort of you were sort of required by this will to prove your innocence as well. So you were well placed to do this.
Yeah, absolutely. And so basically at this point where we'd run out of money, I then didn't have enough money to do my B sample, because this might surprise you that an athlete, if they want to do their B sample, so when you do your urine sample in the first place, you split it into two pots. The A sample is tested by the laboratory and the B sample is left so that if you want to do another test, you can be present and you can have a representative present. And I wanted to do the B sample, but I didn't really query whether it was my sample because it contained my asthma medication. But I still wanted to do the sample. Things can go wrong, but it costs £1,200 plus VAT.
I was going to ask you about that because I can see that's a hell of a lot, but you said you spent that much just on the paracetamol. Why was it that you prioritised, the B sample could potentially have just knocked this on the head initially. If you'd done that, did it accelerate the whole process? Were you playing for time a bit, trying to
No. So basically, the lawyers are experts in this. They do it all the time. It is very, very, very uncommon that the B sample is different to the A sample. The reason they do the B sample is so that they can really see if there are... Because they like to do everything thoroughly. We knew that the chance of the B sample, of it not being my sample, let's say, or there being a process wrong, was so, so, so low that even... Okay, so if the B sample came back and it didn't have the chlortelidone, obviously, great, then the lab have made a mess and I don't have a ban. But it's really unlikely. It's so unlikely. And because, like I said, it had the formoterol in, we knew it was my sample. There was nothing wrong with the sample collection process. I had no problems with that at all. And so, yeah, I wasn't buying for time. I just knew that I was told that if the B sample is also positive, even if we find out from other stuff from that, if we don't find the source, I'm still not going to get less than 2 years. So it's so much more important to spend the 10 grand on testing medications and spend the 20 grand on legal fees and actually understand how this process works than it is to spend. And let's say it's not just £1,200 plus VAT, because if you want anything useful to come from it, you have to pay an analyst to be there. And they have to then go to Paris from London, stay overnight in Paris, come back, everything has to be translated. Actually, in total, it ended up being about £6,000. Because I was in such a state financially and I couldn't afford it, actually Morgan Sports Law offered to pay for everything for me, except for the cost of the test and the cost of the analysts' fees traveling. But I simply didn't have any money left. Like, we were borrowing money from my parents-in-law and from my foster brother. I was already in negative. I simply wasn't prepared to put other people's money on the line for something that we knew was almost certainly going to be positive. Like, it wasn't really a question in my mind whether the B sample would be positive. Yeah. It was just something that I wanted to do.
So you didn't do the B sample, but you tested everything you could, as much as you could, and you were coming up against a brick wall in terms of trying to find where this contamination should have come from. But you started digging more into contamination in pharmaceuticals in general. What did you discover? Because chlortelidone, as I understand it, would be, it's quite different from other diuretics. It's not a particularly useful one in terms of a masking agent, as I understand. Is that what you found?
Yeah. I mean, to be honest, no diuretics are really that useful. In this concentration, none of the diuretics are useful, right? Because I found out on day one that diuretics can contaminate pharmaceuticals, and they do contaminate pharmaceuticals. I then very quickly found out that WADA know this. And in 2021, WADA put out a stakeholder notice saying that there is a problem because there's something called good manufacturing practices. And good manufacturing practice is the protocols by which pharmaceutical manufacturers have to comply by. Pharmaceutical products do not have to be 100% pure. In the manufacturing process, there is likely to be some contamination. Now, that contamination is set at a certain amount, for instance, 10 parts per million. And the amount varies between the different substances, for instance, if it's an injectable or if it's a tablet or if it's an inhaled medication. But this stakeholder notice that WADA put out identified that there is a problem, that within this small enough limit of limit of allowed contamination in the pharmaceutical industry, you can have a positive test in the anti-doping process and you will get an inadvertent AAF, i.e. you will get a positive test from having taken a legitimate medication and it's not your fault. In 2014, there was a case where a Swiss athlete tested positive and he, luckily for him, very quickly got the results, unlike me. The only thing he declared was an NSAID, such as ibuprofen, on his form. He was fortunate enough to have one tablet left in that packet. It was sent off. It was found to be contaminated with hydrochlorothiazide, which is another diuretic. And so from then, this Anti-Doping Switzerland published a study that was published in 2016. And from this point, WADA have known that this is a problem. The other huge problem is that the sensitivity of testing, so the small amount that WADA can detect, is getting smaller and smaller. And in the last 10 years, it has decreased very, very rapidly.
But only in some labs, or some more than others, let's say.
Some more than others, yeah. So there's so many complicated aspects to this. So some labs can measure something down to the picogram, which is a trillionth of a gram, and some labs can only measure down to the amount that is specified by WADA for those substances. Now, for diuretics, the amount that the laboratory has to be able to test diuretics to is 200 nanograms per milliliter. My sample tested positive at 70 nanograms per milliliter of this substance. Now, WADA say that they have this minimum required performance limit, the amount that they have to be able to test down to ensure fairness between laboratories. I say that's absolute rubbish, because if my A sample and my B sample had been sent to two different laboratories, one could have returned a positive finding, you know, a sample that can test down to picograms, and one could have returned a negative finding that can only test down to 200 nanograms per milliliter. So how can that possibly be fair? Mm. So, Tom, you also said about how chlorothalidone is a bit of a funny diuretic, and you're absolutely right. So every diuretic, every substance has a different half-life, and that just means how long it takes for that substance to reduce the quantity that's in your body by half. So most diuretics, their half-lives are 1 to 2 hours. The second longest diuretic half-life is chlorothalidone, which is an average of 7 to 8 hours. Chlorothalidone's average half-life is 48 hours and can be as long as 89 hours. That means when you ingest it, it's going to stay in your body for at least 2 weeks and maybe a lot longer. That also means that when you ingest it, the amount that's in your body after a certain amount of time is going to be a lot higher than other substances. So, for instance, I was saying that in 2021, WADA brought in this stakeholder notice where they said diuretics are a problem, pharmaceuticals can test positive for diuretics, and then athletes can test positive because of that. Now, WADA brought in a minimum reporting limit. So that means that a limit, and this was 20 nanogram per milliliter, and so any test that was below 20 nanogram per milliliter would not be a positive test. However, they only gave it to 6 diuretic substances. And that makes absolutely no sense whatsoever.
Presumably you asked them why that was the case. Why is it only 6?
Oh yes, I asked them. So basically, I'd looked at all of this information and it didn't make any sense. They'd brought in this minimum reporting limit in 2021, and I created this huge table, which you can go and see over on my website, of recording all of the 6,000 diuretics that have happened since 2008. And I worked out that if you had applied this minimum reporting limit in 2019, based on the 2021 figures, then an excess 316 athletes tested positive in 2019 alone. And don't just think like, oh, well, there's more people testing positive than ever before because there's more people cheating. These amounts are indicative of contamination. They are not enough to be a masking agent. They are so low that they don't actually do anything.
You were able to establish that from the fact that when the minimum reporting limit came in,
there was a huge drop
again.
Yeah.
So it had increased and increased while the tests were getting more and more sensitive,
yeah.
And then dropped again when they put the minimum. So you know they were in that little band between 0 and 20 nanograms per liter.
2014, 15, 16, after that date, the proportion of positive tests, the proportion of all tests done that were positive for a diuretic substance was slowly increasing from something like 0.12, 0.14% up to 0.24% in 2019. Then that dropped from 0.24% all the way down to 0.13%.
And were most of those athletes that were test that were triggering the contamination, they all got bans, did they? They got
they would have got bans.
2 year bans.
Yeah. And then just for 2 years later, for them to want to go, sorry, actually you were right all along, but sorry, your life's been ruined now.
Yeah, and well, I'll ask you in a minute, but do you expect those guys to maybe retrospectively challenge this, you know, bearing in mind what we're going to discuss in a minute regarding your case?
You know, I don't know. And the reason that I wanted to tell this story is because, like you mentioned earlier, and the reason that I actually went ahead with this when I was in such a dire place with my own health is because I understood that I was in a unique position. So I didn't have that much money, but to be honest, I was incredibly fortunate to have even had enough money to start with to be able to start this process. I was incredibly fortunate that we were still able to survive on my husband's salary and I was able to work full time on this. I'm so fortunate to have had an amazing education and to also have studied medicine to be able to have the scientific knowledge to do this. And I'd seen so many people, and I was, you know, I was hearing about other athletes in the same situation with the same substance. And I thought, I have to do something about this because I'm uniquely placed to do something about this. And if I can't change this system, I truly believed nobody could. So after creating this massive graph of all these AAFs, I thought, this is crazy. You know, WADA have known something's been going on for years here and they've not done anything about it. I sent all of these questions to my lawyers. Sorry, Tom, you were going to ask a question.
Well, I was going to ask, they didn't WADA have a contaminants working group that was actually looking at all this sort of stuff? You know, you've done all this research, but they have their own group that looks specifically at this.
Yeah, and it was that group that put out their statement in 2021. Mm. This group was created in 2019 because things like diuretics are a problem with contaminations in medication. And I thought, right, well, I've got this contamination. I knew of four other athletes who had the same level, roughly, in the same ballpark as me, same substance. None of us knew how it had got there. And I thought, well, WADA must know there's a problem. This must be on their list. So I sent a bunch of questions to my lawyers, who then sort of did a lawyerish version and sent it off to WADA. And WADA replied saying, chlortalidone is not known as a contaminant of medication or meat. There is therefore no reason for the contaminants working group or other WADA group or body to consider introducing an MRL for this substance. And I thought, hold on a second. So you're waiting for somebody to have a pharmaceutical be contaminated with chlortalidone and then have enough money and the good fortune to have that pharmaceutical still, find it, test positive for it, create a scientific study for you, submit it to WADA, and then God knows, I don't know, 8 years, let's use the history of WADA as an example, 8 years later, you're then going to introduce a limit. So you're literally saying, oh, because nobody's tested positive for it yet, we're not going to do anything about it. This simply wasn't good enough for me. So I asked my lawyers to send another email. WADA then replied again saying, they just gave us a list of how many positives there had been for chlortalidone in the last numbers of years, which actually, incidentally, they got wrong. But never mind. So then I asked them again another question. Now, at this point, WADA started to get, I would say, the tone of the email sounded quite frustrated with us. And WADA replied with this. I refer to your third letter to WADA concerning chlortalidone. WADA has tried to be helpful by responding to your first two letters. This is where it gets good. With respect to this latest request, WADA does not keep a log of all products, if any, that have been asserted or found, rightly or wrongly, to have been contaminated with chlortalidone or other prohibited substances. Moreover, and more generally, WADA does not have the human resources to conduct research in respect of matters arising in first instance cases, of which there are hundreds at any given time, to which it is not a party.
So basically, they're not keeping the records of any of these contaminants.
WADA don't keep records.
Yeah.
WADA do not keep records of what has been contaminated with what. But WADA literally just emailed us saying chlortalidone is not known as a contaminant of medication or meat. Therefore, there's no reason for the contaminants working group or other body to consider introducing an MRL. But so they don't keep records. So how can they possibly know?
So do you think this is a problem with the working group or with WADA itself? I mean, were the working group not doing, or did they not have the funds? I mean, we know that WADA and you kind of desperately underfunded. Do you feel that they don't have the resource to be looking into this? They're just relying on athletes to do it themselves, or they're just being lazy? Or
in my opinion, and with my experience of WADA so far, it seems like they are so concerned with keeping the status quo that they just don't have time for anything else. I genuinely think that the problem is, if they acknowledged that pharmaceuticals really were a problem, then they would also therefore have to acknowledge that there is a problem with human rights, because it is a human right to have the highest attainable standard of health, and it is a human right to work without discrimination, not just because you choose to be an athlete, you shouldn't be able to therefore look after your health. And in my experience, my human rights have been infringed because I haven't been able to maintain my health and abide by the rules of my work. You know, I've been suspended, I haven't been paid, my mental health has gone in the absolute bin, my physical health has gone in the bin, everything I work for has been destroyed because I literally just took the medications to keep me healthy. And I think the problem is, if WADA acknowledge this, they risk their whole system falling apart. And I really want to be clear here that I have absolutely no intention to try and bring WADA down, but I am desperate to incite change because I have been through hell. The reality is that I spent many of the last months feeling suicidal, and I don't take that lightly. I had to see a psychiatrist. I'm taking antidepressants. I have medication in case I have a complete panic and a complete meltdown. My husband has had also severe side effects of, you know, the harrowing times that he's seen me in a really, really bad place. And these are scars that may never heal. We are a good way through this healing journey, but WADA have to do something about this, because I am seriously, seriously concerned that an athlete will take their own life. That is my biggest concern, and that's why
I've spoken to other athletes through this who have been through similar experiences now during the course of your investigation.
I've only directly spoken to one other athlete with chlortalidone, because generally the other three athletes, my lawyers spoke through their lawyers and we were advised not to speak to each other. I actually haven't spoken to other cyclists for whom this had the same, you know, for whom the same thing happened, because it's such a sensitive topic, and I'm sure they would also retain confidentiality. But, you know, we're 10 months in and the number of people that I've told is actually quite a lot. But it's a testament to all those people that none of this has leaked, because I clearly have a very good circle around me.
So you going through this, obviously your mental state is horrific. You also, I think, had a massive crash, didn't you, last autumn in the middle of all this?
Yeah. I was about a week away from having to respond to the charge letter. So I remember I was on a ride to Annecy when I received this charge letter from UCAD, and it's just horrible. I just received this letter saying, you are being charged with anti-doping rule violations for presence and use of this. And it feels like you're in criminal proceedings. It's horrible. And then a few days later, I was out mountain biking and I had this awful accident on my mountain bike. I crashed and I shattered my jaw into so many pieces. I've knocked 5 of my teeth out. I had to have massive reconstructive surgery. And so then that actually got delayed. We actually the lawyers wrote to UCAD on my behalf and said, she's had this accident. Can she have an extension on
responding?
Yeah. And here's her arrêt de travail, her stop work notice from the French hospital. And they responded saying, why does this mean that you're not able to work on the case? And I just thought, are you joking? I've had major surgery on my face. They go up through your lip and they pull your face back. I've got 16 screws. I had a metal arc. I had 3 screws in my bottom jaw. And they're like, oh, why can't you work?
Well, that maybe answers my next question, because throughout this, you know, how were the dealings with UCAD? Because it's coming to a head. It's coming to a head now. You've done all this research. You've questioned WADA. They've been unsatisfactory in getting back to you. You're getting to the case where UCAD were insistent that nothing you did was going to make a difference because you couldn't prove the contamination anywhere. So they were going to go through with a 2-year ban. I mean, how were relations with UCAD at this point?
What's interesting is that there were kind of two parts to my relationship. Well, three parts to my relationship with UCAD, let's say. There's the first part where you're going through the lawyers, where they are, am I allowed to say, willy waving at each other? Basically, who's got the biggest what's it? And it really was like that. I felt like my life is on the line and you are just trying to get one over on each other. And not with my lawyers. Like, we would ask really reasonable questions. We explained multiple times that my investigation was progressing at a slower rate because I was doing a lot of investigating myself. I didn't have much funds. I was trying so hard to get in contact with pharmaceutical companies to try and trace these specific, the specific brand of the specific tablet that I'd had 3 months ago, and it was so difficult. And also I found out that the specific tablet that we are most suspicious of was actually taken off the shelves at the end of September 2023. And I found out this information in October 2023, and UCAD were like, oh, your case isn't different to trying to find a piece of meat. And I'm like, but you're asking me to find a pharmaceutical that I already swallowed 3 months ago that isn't sold anymore. How is it not unique? Yeah. Anyway, sorry. We've got this first part of the relationship where there's the lawyers emailing them and they're just, trying to do everything to antagonize each other. And then when I ceased official representation with the lawyers, it was like a different UCAD. They were so nice to me. Mm. And I couldn't really understand what was going on. They were very kind. They sent me an email saying, just to let you know, this is how it works. We're not trying to prove intent. We don't think you've done anything, but you're going to have 2 years ban. So kind of nice. And then I then wrote my huge submissions.
144 pages.
The 144 pages was the very final submissions. I think the first one was only 99, Tom. And the reason why I believed that I shouldn't have a ban is because there's two specific parts of the WADA rules. One that says you can have no fault or negligence, which means no ban, if you can show that you've shown the utmost care in regards of your anti-doping responsibilities. And I really could. I had proof of emails where I'd sent... where I told doctors that I couldn't increase my aspirin medication because of anti-doping rules, even though I was so breathless I couldn't walk upstairs and I was having a crisis with my asthma. I had proof of where I've contacted UK anti-doping and said, like, there's problems with your anti-doping app. I had proof of when I was living in France, I ordered supplements to the UK and went back to get them because I was so scared of getting anything else. I had so much proof. I remember when I was speaking to Lionel and Rose on a podcast about this months ago, before the podcast, I'd gone to a race, been given a box of chocolates, and the chocolates had my face on them. And I didn't eat a single one because I was so worried that they might be tainted. So I knew that I had the evidence to prove that I'd shown the utmost care. But then the other problem is, it says you have to prove, you have to establish the source of the contamination. Now, my point, and this is also the Court of Arbitration's for Sport's point, and also WADA's point, actually, what in WADA's rules, it says that the standard of proof is on the balance of probabilities. So I was absolutely, very, very, very clear. And I think it's incredibly clear from my submissions that the balance of probability shows that it's most likely that a contaminated medication caused this contamination with chlortalidone. We know scientifically diuretics contaminate medications. There is nothing, no scientific reason why only these six that WADA have specified should be contaminants and others should not. One study back in 2016 said that there should be a minimum reporting limit for all diuretics of 200 nanograms per milliliter to prevent exactly this happening. And WADA just did nothing about it. They did nothing about it for 5 years, and then they did a very, very half-assed version of dealing with it.
But UCAD were insistent on this. Nothing you do, unless you find the source of the contamination, is going to make a difference. You're going to get it. But you still had one potential avenue of investigation, which was the hair.
Yeah. So UKAD said, no, you're only going to get 2 years, even though all of the case law from the Court of Arbitration for Sport was completely on my side and showed that, again, I should really have no fault on the balance of probabilities. And in UKAD's written submissions, they said that there had been a case very recently which was the same substance, and this athlete had had a reduced ban, I think it was 9 months maybe, because his hair sample had shown that he basically was subject to a very, very low contamination dose and only for a certain period. Now, in UKAD's written submissions, they said, well, the difference between your case and this case is that you haven't done this hair sample. Now, I received UKAD's written submissions only 2.5 weeks or something before the tribunal was supposed to be. And at this point, I wasn't supposed to be allowed to have extra evidence. So I had to ask special permission to be allowed to give this hair sample.
When did you find out about this other athlete and the hair sample? And presumably, you would have done
pretty
that
pretty recently. Yeah.
You would have done that last summer. Presumably, it would have been one of the first things you did had you known about that.
No. Because I was again told right from the beginning, I was told you can do a hair sample, but even if you have a hair sample indicative, unless you find the source of contamination. So now that's why this case that I'd just found out about and that had only just happened was so critical. Because before that, even if you had the hair sample, you still had to find
so
the
initial
thing.
So that was your primary concern, was finding the source of the contamination?
Yeah, exactly. And this case was one of the first instances, this other case that I can't really talk about, was one of the first instances where an athlete had actually had a reduced sanction. They hadn't found the original specific source, but they'd had a reduced sanction based on the fact that the hair sample and other things showed that they didn't actually ingest a medical amount of this.
But
this
had you saved a hair sample at the time in case
you had?
I mean, was that just a stroke of luck or was that something?
So when I went to 5 days after I found out about this, I drove overnight to Strasbourg. I left home at 12 o'clock, at 12 midnight, and arrived at 5 a.m. because in order to get my medications there as soon as I possibly could to test them, because that's where the laboratory was. And I was recommended at that point, because I was there and it was the same guy, he'd take a sample of my hair.
Right.
So he's had it since August and he hadn't done anything about it, because I was also told it cost between £3,000 and £5,000. And I was like, well, what's the point in doing it if I haven't found the source?
Yeah.
But then when this athlete came along, I also then hadn't done it later because, well, I ran out of money. I hadn't done it later because I felt my evidence was so strong that on the balance of probabilities, the standard used by CAS and said by WADA, which is their standard for proof in the WADA code, it says that the standard for proof is balance of probabilities. My case was clear on the balance of probabilities. I said in my submissions, it wasn't just on the balance of probabilities, it was a heavily laden seesaw. Like, it was so blindingly obvious. And anyway, so I had to say to UKAD, can I do this? UKAD and the tribunal panel, can I do this hair test? UKAD said, we don't object to you doing it, but whatever the hair test says, it's not going to change our position at all. Did the hair test. Surprisingly, it came back indicative of contamination.
Just explain how that works, because the hair test, just explain to the listeners how that works, because as I understand it, they can date, you know, from which part of the hair they're testing.
Yeah. So when I went to the laboratory, they cut my hair right next to my scalp, and then I've got relatively long hair, so there was plenty. The growth rate there's an average growth rate of hair, which is like roughly a centimetre a month off the top of my head, so don't quote me on that. And so they take it in sections. And so I think it was the three sections before the test were all negative. And then there's the section around the period of just before the test, which had this tiny contamination of 4 picograms per milligram. And then the three sections, those are the 3 months after the test, were also all negative. So then this got sent to UKAD. Then UKAD got their expert to have a look at it. And then UKAD decided that actually, she has been right all along. And even though they'd literally less than one week earlier, said that we are not going to change the way we put our case at all, they then said, actually, we're doing a complete 180, and we don't want to go to the tribunal. We want to give you no fault or negligence, and no sanction and no ban, and we just want this to just be over.
Where were you when you got that news?
I was on the phone by the window in my house. My husband was sat on the sofa, and I very calmly replied, and my husband was just sat there. I repeated, and I said, so you want to give no fault or negligence, so that he would know. And he just put his head in his hands, like in absolute despair.
But I mean, on the surface, in one sense, that was a victory, because as you say, they've U-turned, but their requirement for offering you that was that you had to accept a no fault or negligence rather than just throwing the whole thing out the window. It would still get marked down as a positive test.
But they were never going to throw the whole thing out the window, right? Because the way it works is, even if you get no fault, you've still got an anti-doping rule violation. So it's a bit confusing. There's an AAF and an ADRV. The AAF is the substance in your system. The anti-doping rule violation is that you have broken a rule by the presence and use. I hate that term because I think it implies knowing use, but use is something getting into your body by any means. So I now have 4 anti-doping rule violations for the presence and use of chlortalidone, and this is the really ridiculous one, for the presence and use of formoterol, which is a medication I have taken for years on medical grounds to treat medically diagnosed asthma. But the problem was,
you take it in conjunction with the diuretic.
So when there's a diuretic, even at a contamination level, you get an automatic AAF for this substance. And we said, like, well, firstly, there are 2 differing rules in the WADA code that are against each other and should basically, it means it should be dismissed. Secondly, you should not have a position where an athlete is terrified to take a medication. Like, it's just inhumane. And because I'm exposed to a contamination dose, it is grossly unfair that I have an AAF for a medicine I take to treat a chronic health condition. But UCAD told me on the phone that they'd spoken to WADA about this, and if they threw out the AAF for formoterol, WADA, they knew that WADA would appeal. So I was forced into a corner of basically either going to a tribunal, which was, I didn't really think it was a risk, or accepting the ADRVs for formoterol. And I knew that if I accepted the ADRVs for formoterol, this case would set a precedent for other athletes, for the national anti-doping organizations to be able to give a no-fault finding when the specific source of the substance hasn't been found. And that is massive. Like, I understand from my lawyers and from UCAD that that's never been done before.
They've never done a U-turn on this and found a...
Well, they've never given no-fault when the actual substance hasn't been identified.
Yeah, I've got to ask, Lizzie, you mentioned it was a settlement offer from UCAD. Does that involve any compensation? Because, as you say, you're out of pocket some £40,000 now.
Yeah, plus the salary I lost last year, which was a lot, plus the obviously inability to work this year, and plus the fact that my name is going to be tarnished for the rest of my life, plus the amount I've spent on psychiatrists and the debilitating effect on my mental and physical health.
Was there any offer of compensation?
No. So one of the things that I wanted at the tribunal was for the costs to be attributed. And part of the settlement with UCAD was that the costs would lie where they fall. I wasn't happy with this, but I mean, like you said, we've lost a lot financially, but we are also incredibly lucky. And I knew that I had to remind myself why I was doing this, because I could have gone to a tribunal and I believe I could have got a better personal result. But the only reason that I carried on with this was for other athletes who were going through this hell that I've been through. Because if it was just about me, I'd have just stopped and I'd have gone and studied woodwork 6 months ago, because it wasn't worth it. It simply wasn't worth it if it was just about me. I knew I would never go back to cycling. The reason I carried on is because I had to work to incite change for good, because this system is broken. There needs to be an overhaul. Athletes are not being treated fairly. Athletes are being criminalised for a problem that WADA and UCAD have known about for years and are not educating athletes about. In the WADA rules, it says that they have to educate athletes for things that could cause inadvertent AAFs, and they have to protect athletes' health, and they have to educate athletes about how to protect their health, and they're actively doing the opposite.
Has this made you question everything about UCAD and WADA? I mean, not just the contamination, you've seen they've dropped the ball on that front, in your opinion, but in do you reappraise other athletes that you've seen test positive? Do you look at a case of a Contador with a, you know, a contaminated meat
Contador,
and just think,
yeah,
you know,
yeah,
maybe the guy was harshly judged?
Oh, yeah.
Do you think across the board you're reappraising how you see anti-doping?
Yeah, 100%. I mean, it's completely changed. You know, I would have to say that, and I'm really glad that I did think this, before I was always a bit cautious. You know, with this Bosoit case, it didn't make sense. And I just thought, I always said, especially to my husband, I said, yeah, but can you imagine if that was me? We know how hard I work, how careful I am about contamination. And everybody else would say, oh, yeah, she's just a doper. She's just saying that. And then you're screwed. Your life is over. So I'm quite glad that I kind of like had this scientific, yeah, but what if? But yeah, I still believed in the system. I still believed that they...
Well, it's so important to believe in clean sport,
yeah,
isn't it? And we need UCAD and we need WADA because...
Yeah, at the moment, I believe that the rich athletes and the powerful athletes are getting away with things, let's say, whether or not they have or haven't done things. And normal people, like, well, you know, I actually managed to not have a ban, but I still had my life ruined. And Shari Bosoit and Tunats, like normal people... just having everything taken away from them, like every moral fiber in their life destroyed, every piece of integrity destroyed, their lives destroyed, their health destroyed, relationships destroyed.
Do you think there's also a sort of a prejudice when it comes to nationality as well? Because people will, I mean, and we're probably all guilty of this, you see, you know, we saw the case with the Chinese swimmers recently.
Yeah, but...
had you been Russian, had you been Chinese, and you heard an athlete say... Oh, you know, it was contamination, teeny amounts, you know, this was completely inadvertent. I imagine a lot of people would raise a quizzical eyebrow and say, yeah, you know.
Well, yeah, but Tom, I know how the process works now.
Yeah.
And with these Chinese swimmers, like, okay, so you know, and the listeners hopefully will know now, I got an AAF. I was proved that I did nothing wrong, but I still have 4 anti-doping rule violations. Now, none of the Chinese swimmers got any anti-doping rule violations. If it was contamination, that's fine. They can have no ban, but they should still have had anti-doping rule violations. Actually, what happened is the Chinese...
just went away.
Chinada just threw it out, and it all just went away.
Yeah,
so as I know, that shouldn't happen. I mean, I also think that, to be honest, that's wrong. If you're found to have no fault or negligence, it shouldn't be made public, because I get no fault or negligence and they still make it public anyway. Actually, in my case, I demanded that they had to make it public, and I said everything has to be made public because I want
that
this
was your condition
to... yeah, that was my condition.
Yeah.
My only condition, well, which they agreed to anyway, was that my case had to be made public so that it could be relied on by other athletes.
I guess I should probably let you go now, but
what's next?
Yeah, what's next? I mean, are you going to continue the anti-doping fight? I mean, are you going to, obviously you've said, I mean, is this officially, you're announcing your career's over, you've retired as an athlete? We hadn't heard that before publicly, but...
I've definitely retired as a cyclist. I've actually entered a 57-kilometre mountain marathon with 3,700 metres of elevation in September, which will be my first run ever. So maybe, you never know, maybe you'll see me in trail running in the future. But yeah, I mean, I've retired from cycling. I'm never going back to it. But yeah, what's next? Well, currently, as we speak, we're actually 2 days away from the appeals deadline closure. However, WADA get an extra 21 days to appeal. And I learned yesterday that they've just asked for the case file. So I hope they won't appeal. I honestly do not believe what they could possibly have to appeal or what grounds they could appeal on. I would say please go and read everything that I've written on my website, because there's a much more in-depth and detailed account of everything. There's references to every single rule that WADA's put out there, references to all sorts of scientific evidence. So please go over there and read that. And I plan to write an open letter to WADA and say what I believe needs changing. And if they don't comply, I will try and take this to the European Court of Human Rights, because I believe there have been huge human rights infringements.
You've also taken up woodworking, I think.
I've also taken up woodworking, yeah. Since I did my, you know, we went to the UK for the tribunal that never happened, and then I came back and I took up woodworking. I made three cat tables for cats. Means that their necks are much more neutral when they're eating, so they're much less likely to vomit. I've made a mirror and I've made a toilet roll holder, and my next project is a luxury cat house, and my brand is called Atelier Sauvage. as in chasse sauvage, the wild cat, and sauvage, like wood, wild wood. So if anybody's in need of a cat table, they can contact Lizzie Banks at ateliersauvage.com. I haven't actually
made that
yet.
Well, it's excellent to see you found an outlet for your frustrations, but obviously...
Well, it's been the best therapy I could have asked for, honestly.
Yeah, I guess that's all the stuff to say is best of luck, because although we, you know, lighten the tone at the end there with cat tables, you know, I know that had this gone to tribunal, you were going to make a pretty powerful submission there about other athletes and the dangers, and I think it's worth coming back to that just at the end, what this has taken away from you. You are 10 months on, still not in a great place, and what it could do to other athletes.
Yeah, absolutely. I think maybe I'll just finish by reading you the end of my closing statement that I never got to use. This closing statement refers to an athlete called Jack Berg, who tested positive for a diuretic at less than 1 nanogram per milliliter. Since 2021, as I said earlier, the UCI have had a 20 nanogram per milliliter minimum reporting limit for that specific diuretic, as this level is so clearly indicative of contamination. Jack continues to go through hell because of WADA's ignorance of the issues. The matter below is at the heart of why I'm so determined to make a change. Despite being shown to bear no fault or negligence by the Court of Arbitration for Sport, and despite having a hydrochlorothiazide contamination at a level which now wouldn't even result in an AAF, Jack Burke's life continues to be affected. He receives hate mail and messages on social media continuing to accuse him of doping. Getting an award of no fault or negligence is not a win. It is still a life sentence, especially in cycling. These rules must change. WADA's policy must change. I am lucky. I am really incredibly very lucky. This process pushed me right to the edge of my psychological capacity. There have been many times in the past 9 months when my husband, my friends, and me included, were seriously concerned that this process had pushed me beyond the edge. I cannot describe the pain that we have both felt, the utter destruction of our lives, of everything we had planned for the future. Despite all the meticulous care we took and thousands of hours of work we put in, so many sacrifices were made. Weddings missed, Christmases missed, birth of nieces missed. Sacrifices which are simply not worth it when my life has been thrown away by it like this by no fault of my own. I cannot bear to think of other honest and hardworking athletes going through what we have been through. And most critically, I gravely fear that an athlete in my situation will end up taking their own life. Precedents must be set by someone, and I beg you to start here by inciting the change that the sporting world so desperately needs.
In response to Lizzie going public with her story, UCAD has put out the following statement. UK Anti-Doping confirms that Ms. Banks has committed anti-doping rule violations, ADRVs, and that the applicable period of ineligibility has been eliminated on the basis that Ms. Banks bore no fault or negligence for those ADRVs. UCAD also notes Ms. Banks' comments with concern and will be looking into what it can do to better support athletes going through anti-doping rule violation proceedings. Ordinarily, UCAD would not comment on the facts of a specific case until the expiry of all appeal windows, at which time the decision would be published in full in accordance with the reporting requirements of the UK anti-doping rules. The World Anti-Doping Agency, WADA, also gave the following response. The issue of possible contamination is real and one that WADA is addressing. The WADA Contaminants Working Group was created for the purpose of providing expert advice and recommendations with regards to prohibited substances that can be prevalent contaminants based on the best available scientific evidence. The group contains many experts in this field from different parts of the world. Over the years, the minimum reporting limits for various substances have been adjusted to ensure fairness for athletes who unintentionally ingest a prohibited substance while protecting against those who would cheat the system. Moreover, the code has, through its various editions, adopted an increasingly flexible and tailored sanction regime that aims to impose appropriate consequences to reflect the nature of the anti-doping rule violation. A specific provision was introduced to allow greater flexibility for cases involving contaminated products. This is a complex and nuanced area of anti-doping in which WADA always strives to strike the right balance for the good of athletes and clean sport.
The Cycling Podcast was created in 2013 by Richard Moore, Daniel Freeb, and Lionel Burney.